Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Jaleh Dahi, an Iranian-American, and I'll moderate the tonight's program. A few words about myself, if I may. I'm a biologist by training and I started my career in academia for some 27 odd years, at Rutgers University, and then on to University of Wisconsin in Madison. I was professor and administrator there. During the time that I was in academia, I took assignments in Washington, D.C., and served as the science liaison to the president, National Science and Technology Council, and at the same time also served as head of two national professional organizations, Association for Women in Science and Council of Scientific Society Presidents. After a number of years in academia, the David and Lucile Packard Foundation recruited me in late 1990s, and I came to California as head of the science and technology program at the foundation. Currently, I'm managing partner of Aurora Equity, which is a company that invests in startup technology companies.
I think I should be interviewing you.
Yeah. No. Well, so tonight's program is part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. We thank them for that. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our very special guest, Firouzeh Dumas, author of the books Funny in Farsi and Laughing Without an Accent. So please welcome me, welcome Firouzeh joining us tonight.
Well, thank you for having me.
I guess I should introduce you as well because everybody has read your bio, but I'm going to give you a little bit of her accomplishment. Firouzeh was born in Abadan, Iran, southwestern Iran, and moved to Vidya, California at the age of 7. After 2 years' stay, she and her family moved back to Iran for a couple years. Then they came back to California and settled in Newport Beach. Firouzeh attended UC Berkeley and majored in humanities and met her husband, who is a Frenchman, and obviously from her last name, you know he's Mr. Monsieur Dumas.
That's what I call him.
Yeah. Firouzeh grew up listening to her father, a former Fulbright scholar, recount the many colorful stories of his life. In 2001, with no prior writing experience, Firouzeh decided to write her stories as a gift to her children. Random House published the book Funny in Farsi in 2003. And the book became a bestseller on the San Francisco Chronicle and LA Times list of bestsellers. And it was a finalist for Penn USA Award in 2004 and a finalist in 2005 for an Audi Award for Best Audiobook. She lost to Bob Dylan. She likes to lose to famous people. She was also a finalist for the prestigious Turber Prize for American Humor, the first Middle Eastern woman ever to receive this honor. Unfortunately, she lost to Jon Stewart. Critics and readers of all ages have loved her stories. President Jimmy Carter made this comment. He said, "A humorous and introspective chronicle of life filled with love of family, country, and heritage." Orange County Reads One Book selected Funny in Farsi for Community Reads 2004. And many, many cities in California, all over the U.S., have also selected her book as their part of Community Reads One Book. The list is very, very long, I assure you. So In the interest of time, perhaps I can move on. For the past 5 years, Firuzeh has traveled all over the country, from high schools to colleges, from churches to synagogues to Muslim centers, and every place she's gone, the audiences have embraced her, loved her stories, and want her to come back. Now, interestingly enough, the Persian version of Funny in Farsi is currently one of the best-selling books in Iran. They need a little bit of humor, given the tensions that are going on. And ABC has optioned her Funny in Farsi as a potential sitcom, and we are interested in hearing about that. Firuzeh's second book, Laughing Without an Accent, a series of autobiographical essays, was published also by Random House in May 2008. So on to the questions and the real interview. Let me ask you first, I am amazed at the level of details that you remember about your childhood, about what your parents did, who seemed to be funny to you at that time. I have not been to Iran myself for a long time, but I hardly remember anything. I can't even remember the street I grew up on. Tell me, were you? You don't seem like the quiet kid who went into the background and absorbed every darn little detail. Were you that kind of a kid, or were you all?
That was me. That was me. I was the I'm the youngest in my family, and my brothers are 10 and 7 years older than I am. And so my mom would take me everywhere with her, and I was the quiet kid. And I always had a purse with me, and I would have my own things in there. So I would just sit there, and I'd empty the contents, and I would just sit and listen to all the grown-ups talking. And that's what I did. That was my childhood, was spent listening to other people talk.
And you must have a photographic...
I'm getting my revenge now.
Yeah. So here's... maybe I can follow on with a question. So you remember the details of the conversations. Do you have a photographic memory of the shapes and colors and the smells?
Smells, you know, take me back. But I'll tell you a story about memory. I have a memory for pretty much useless things. But, you know, where I left my keys, things like that, I have a really hard time with. But I was at a conference 4 years ago, and I met a gentleman whose last name was Brandt. And the next year I was at the conference, and I saw him, and he had a name tag, and it said something Crumpacker. And I said, that's not your name. He said, no, they ran out of name tags, and they gave me this one. I just saw him last month. I just ran into him last month, and I said, hello, Mr. Crumpacker. And he said, what? And I said, do you remember your name tag last time said Crumpacker? And he said, he just stood there, and he said, I can't believe you'd remember that. See, why do I remember that? I don't know. Useless information. But you can't forget a name like Crumpacker, so...
In your book, the message that comes across very, very clearly is that you obviously cherish your Persian-Iranian heritage. And at the same time, you appreciate the lifestyle, the American lifestyle you have, the new country you have adopted for yourself. And of course, you're married to a Frenchman. So tell me, how much are you Iranian, how much are you American, and how much French is in you? I'm sure you're a combination, but give us a sense of the divisions inside of you. Do they fight?
Well, I think in certain areas I'm very Iranian. Like, I love to feed people. You know, if you come to my house, you know, you have to eat a meal with us. And then I always also make way too much food. So that part is very Iranian. The part of me that's very American is I really believe in speaking up and in being counted and voting. And you know, I'm the first person, if I'm somewhere and there's great service, I'll write a letter of praise. And so I really believe in that my voice counts. And I think that is a very American part of me. So it surprises me when people, like, don't vote or don't get involved in something, because I always say, you know, you have so much more power than you think. And the part of me that's French... Well, let's see. I do love detail, and I think France is a culture.
Yes, they're about finesse.
It's all about the details. So, yeah. And there's a lot of subtlety in the French culture. Yes. You know, the food's never too salty, not too sweet. It's so I like that about them a lot.
Yeah. Okay, so let me ask you a related question. Is there anything about the Persian culture that to this day bugs the heck out of you?
Oh, God, it's a long list.
And there's one. Give us one from the Iranian culture and one from the American culture to this day bugs you.
Well, I'll tell you. The thing that bugs me about the Iranian culture is people are incredibly nosy. Like, it's just too nosy, you know, too gossipy. But then what bugs me about the American culture is I think people can be too isolated. Like, I feel like your neighbor could die and no one will know. So it's like maybe we could bring those two cultures halfway.
Is there something about American culture, you know? The fact that you can die as a neighbor and they would not know?
Yeah, exactly, right.
Yeah. Would you be interested to know what bugs me about my...
What bugs you about this culture, about the American culture?
Potlucks.
Potlucks?
Because, like you said, when somebody comes to my house, I want to feed them. I don't want them to bring
food. I won't bring anything to your house.
Okay, but I've got used to the notion of potluck. So many times we get together with potluck, and I now appreciate it because it's a good way of sharing. So... I think among the audience and many of our listeners are aspiring authors to be, including myself. You know, I have written many, many scholarly papers, but I wish to write something that is fun. How do we start? If you are not trained in humanities, where at least you have the skills, even if you don't know you're going to be a writer, where do we begin, those who aspire to be writing a fun book like yours?
Well, I would say the most important thing is to join a writer's group. Because what people do is they often write something and then they tell their husband or wife, honey, what do you think? And, you know, that's a very unfair question. You know, it's like, honey, how do I look in these, you know, horizontally striped pants? You can't ask certain questions. But a writer's group is great because there's no emotional baggage and people can be honest with you. So I recommend that. And, you know, write for the fun of writing. Don't write because you want to get published. Because the publishing world is crazy. I mean, Tori Spelling's book was number one on the New York Times bestseller list. And that's like, I had to go lie down when I saw that. So I would say write for the love of writing.
Yeah. And you know, sometimes it's finding a publisher, I assume, would be difficult. Do you have any...
You assume correctly,
yeah.
Yes.
Do you think the younger generation, at least, who are more... tech savvy, should they go the route of self-publishing?
See, now I really don't know because I think the publishing world is changing so much. I'm actually sitting back and seeing where it's going. So I don't have any advice to give because when I got published, which wasn't that long ago, but even since then, publishing world has changed so much. Bookstores have disappeared.
Yeah.
And you know, the independents are unfortunately really struggling to survive. And that really changes the publishing world because we are now going towards the books that do well, that sell a lot, are books of celebrities.
Hmm.
You know, so the average person, you know, the average unknown person now has an even more difficult time getting published.
Hmm.
So it's really unfortunate. I mean, I think it's just a dumbing down of America.
Okay. In a recent article that was published in April 2009... you wrote an article entitled, "Hey Americans, Appreciate Your Freedom of Speech." You definitely sounded like, or seems like, you don't have any plans to go back to Iran anytime soon. And you are concerned about what is going on. And so you're trying to convey to Americans to cherish more their freedom of speech. I haven't been to Iran for many years as well. Does it make you sad? Do you regret that you cannot go to Iran?
It makes me very sad. Oh, I'd love to go. It makes me very, very sad that I can't go. And I mean, I have relatives there that I haven't seen in 30 years. And I would love to be able to go. But, you know, if I go, I'm sure I would be thrown in prison. And as much as I want to be on CNN, it's not because I was put in prison. So...
Why would you be thrown in prison?
Well, my funny in Farsi, the Persian version, has done remarkably well in Iran. It's done better in Iran than it has done in the United States. And the government's written against me. And, you know, I mean, I'm also somebody who writes, I write pieces for NPR all the time. And I fit the stereotype of what they would consider, I don't know what. I'm sure they would put some label on me.
Hmm.
And that's like the odd thing. I mean, when you're an Iranian and you speak up about anything, I mean, I've read things about me on the internet that say, you know, I'm working for the American government. I've read things that say I'm a monarchist. I've read things that say I'm working for the Iranian government. I mean,
just to be funny, you say these things just to be funny, or are you really?
No, really. I have really read articles saying this, and I think, my God, I can't even get my kids to make their beds. I mean, this is the truth. and I'm being, you know, all these labels are put on me. It's very sad, but, you know, when you're Iranian and you say anything, there's always suspicion, like, well, who's she working for? It's like, you know, I'm working for me. But that's too simple an answer, and people always think there's something else.
And what about your parents? Are they, have they gone back and visited relatives?
Well, I hate to say this, but ever since my book really took off, they haven't gone back either.
So that's the price of celebrity, I guess, you pay.
Well, it's ironic, too, because I don't make a cent from the sales in Iran, because it's not part of international copyright laws.
Right.
So any book can be translated and sold there. So I have a best-selling book in a country where, A, I can't visit, and B, I get no royalty from. I know, I'm one hell of a businesswoman. I think
it seems to me you should go back just to claim your royalties.
No.
As I was reading your books.
But can I just say one thing?
Yes.
Even though, you know, I don't get anything from the sales of the book, I have to say it's been so gratifying for me to receive emails from Iranians who tell me that. And I get so many of these where they say, like, they had never heard their mother laugh until they read this book.
Oh, hi.
And I received a lot of emails from Iranians telling me that in the evenings their family gets together and they read stories out loud from the book. Oh. So, you know what? That's worth more to me than any royalty check. So,
are you in touch or networked with other Iranian authors, like the author of Lolita in Tehran, at least the Iranian Americans who are authors and...
You know, it's not that I network, because there isn't much to do in terms of networking. Being a writer is kind of an odd job. I mean, first of all, you work by yourself. And it's not as if maybe networking would actually help me. But I mean, I know Azza and FEC, and I know Marjan Satrapi. In fact, she gave me this necklace for my birthday.
Azan Afisi wrote Lolita.
Reading Lolita in Tehran.
For those of you who are listening.
And Marjan wrote Persepolis.
Yeah,
and
which became a movie,
right?
Animated movie,
excellent movie, excellent book. Both of those books actually are very good. But as far as networking, no. I mean, we probably should, huh? Form some like legion, and then we'd be like blamed for everything, though.
Yeah,
it'd be like anything that. But and even today, though, like if my uncle is waiting for a check from Iran that's late, they're like, it's because of Firuze's book, I think. So I already get blamed for a lot.
You know, when I was reading your books, I read Funny in Farsi many years ago when it came out. Not many years ago, just, you know, maybe 2003 or 2004. And I recently read your second book. And I kept thinking, the person that popped up in my mind as I was reading your book was Irma Bombeck.
Oh, thank you.
So I said, well, she's the Iranian version of Irma Bombeck.
I often describe myself by saying that, so
yeah.
Thank you.
So has anybody called you that?
Myself.
Myself.
I have, yeah.
Wait, so now you can count me as the second, I seconded the motion, right? So are there other Iranian women in Iran or abroad anywhere that use humor to write or write plays or whatever for any entertainment purposes? Do they use that as humor?
You know, I'm sure there are. I'm not aware of them, but I'm sure there are.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, look, you know, I mean, humor is such a big part of our culture.
Yeah.
And Americans are shocked when they hear that.
Yeah.
I mean, just because Ahmadinejad doesn't have humor doesn't mean that the people, actually how the people survive is humor.
Yeah. Well, actually, I mean, I don't know how to be funny. I have to confess. It's one of those regrets that God gives you a lot of gifts, but that's not what God gave me, being funny like the way you are.
I didn't have the gift of being a biology professor, so we could trade.
We are even then. Okay, I'll take that. But, you know, as an Iranian, I, born and raised in Iran, I see Iranians use humor to cover a lot of serious things they want to talk about and they don't want to say it. They use humor. Mm-hmm. Am I right?
Oh, yeah.
Is that a correct impression?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm not totally an Iranian. having lived so long outside of Iran. All right, let's go to another question. But before doing that, for our listeners, you're listening to Commonwealth Club radio program. We are talking with Firuzeh Dumal, Iranian-American author of Funny in Farsi and Laughing Without an Accent. Okay, so you've written two books. You're famous. I assume you're rich because bestsellers. What is your next book? Or is it a different project? Are you working on another endeavor?
Well,
or a third book?
What I'm spending a lot of time on right now is I'm on the lecture circuit, and I travel the country talking about shared humanity. I use humor to talk about shared humanity. Okay. So I go all over the country. And, you know, I discovered a few years ago, I was speaking at a school, and I discovered that a lot of kids, the sort of post-September 11th generation, equate the Middle East with terrorism and not much else. And so that was sort of my aha moment, and I thought, well, you know, I think I need to go and speak to every single American. And so that's what I'm trying to do. And, you know, it's interesting because I don't get any attention from the media, because if you're a Middle Easterner and if you want to get attention in the media, you have to hate somebody. And so when you're talking about shared humanity,
well,
you are completely left alone.
Pretend you hate somebody, get their attention, huh?
Well, you know, lately with some of the crazy fringe Republicans, I think I'm finding it a group. I need to speak to them more than anybody else. But although I'm afraid someone would yell, "You lie!" in the middle. So I'm really dedicated to speaking literally to as many people as I can. And in fact, I'm getting ready to go to Virginia and Arkadelphia. Anybody know where Arkadelphia is? I love going to places where Americans have never heard of Arkadelphia. It's in this country.
Well, what is it?
It's in Arkansas.
Oh.
And I'm God bless them. They've invited me to Arkadelphia. Although, okay, truth be told, they wanted to have Marjan Satrapi, but they couldn't get her. And so this is the truth. So they got me. They're going to get me. So.
Oh, lucky. They should be so lucky. Okay, so you mentioned the terrorists and the wrong impressions of Americans that may have, or some Americans may have, of Middle Easterners. And I remember when the hostage crisis happened, all of us, I was a student, graduate student at the time, we all were looked as terrorists. Not anymore. Americans know a lot more about Iran than they used to. But what struck me as I read your books was that even though politics lends itself to humor, you seem to be proactively avoiding politics. Why?
Because that's the only politics is the only thing that gets attention when it has to do with Iran. I mean, how many times have you seen anything on the news in America that has something to do other than with politicians? And so I wanted to just bring the average person to light, the average Iranian. So I just thought, you know, the politics is in the background, and the average person, which is like my father, is going to be in the foreground. So I very purposefully wanted to just show readers what just an average Iranian family is like. I mean, they don't need for me to describe Ahmadinejad to them or Khomeini. You know, they've already seen enough images.
But you could have made, were you concerned that if you made them sound funny that there would be repercussions?
I don't know how to make them sound funny. I'm not a miracle worker, you know?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. Okay. Yeah. Your parents must be absolutely proud of what you have accomplished. Although I'm sure they were shocked when you didn't become an engineer and you went into humanities, because this is not what Iranians of that generation would value. So being so proud of you, give us a little bit of an example and a flavor of when you go to some big event, how would your parents talk about you and express their pride about you? Give us a sense of their Iranian-ness, proud Iranian-ness,
well,
and you.
You know, I'll tell you this. Because we live in different cities, we don't often go to events together. But one thing that they do, though, and I repeatedly ask them not to do this, is they give my phone number out to people all the time. And I get calls from people, and they'll say, "Hi, you know, I'm so and so, and you know, your mother gave me your phone number, and they want to talk to me about something. They just want to talk to me." And I have three kids, so I don't have a lot of free time on my hands. So then I call my mother and I say, "Mom, could you please not give my phone number out to people?" And she says, "Do you know who that was? When we lived in Ahvaz, this was the doctor of your cousin. And they were, you know," and I go, "Okay, Mom, that's fine, but don't do this." And sure, you know, every couple of weeks I get a call from some Iranian who has gotten my phone number from my parents. So they're proud, and I kind of feel like they're like pimping me out, but they're, you know, it's, I take that as a sign of pride.
Yeah. So do they give you more things to write about or tell you
stories?
Well,
it goes both ways. I mean, I have relatives who corner me at all family gatherings to tell me a story because they want me to write about it. And then I also have other people who will say, "No, don't tell that to Firuze. It's going to be one of those stories." So I have both. But it's definitely changed the dynamics with my family because people want to be written about, I've discovered. People that you wouldn't think would want to be written about really want to be written about.
Even if it's not flattering.
Right. Yeah. And everybody has a story where they're the hero. And that's the story they want me to write.
Well, I think your next book could be about your heroes, these so-called heroes, right?
I could, and I'd sell 12 copies maybe to the heroes.
Okay. So, all right, so we got a sense of your parents' reaction to your fame and success. How does the Iranian community interact or react to your success and outside your family and relatives?
Do you
get a different reaction from Iranians versus Americans?
Well, the younger generation as a whole, they embrace what I'm trying to do, and they understand that I'm trying to change the image that the media always portrays of Iranians. So I can always count on them to be my fans. The older generation, not always. I like my parents' generation because they feel, most of them have never read the book, but they feel like maybe I've made fun of my family, and you know that's very taboo in our culture.
Yeah.
And a lot of times too, when someone will say, "Well, I just read one story," I go, "Well, you have to read the whole book." And they tend to be people who are most critical, who haven't read the book. I do think it's a generational thing. But overall, I have to say, I mean, Iranians have been so generous in embracing me and my books and really being very, very encouraging.
Yeah. In your second book, Laughing Without an Accent, you have a chapter about going back to Midwest to meet one of the women who was held hostage in the 90s. 1979-1980 hostage crisis. Very touching how kind and forgiving she seems to be, at least from your point of view. What is interesting, you talk about the fact, in that chapter, you talk about how the TV images that were projected at that time were so totally misleading Americans to make totally wrong interpretations. If you were a TV executive right now, today,
God,
2009,
I wish I were.
What sort of a program or subjects or topics would you want a program to focus on in order for Americans or, for that matter, any other culture, have a better understanding of the Iranian culture and the Persian heritage? The fact that so much Arabic culture is being right now mixed with the Persian culture. What would you do? Describe a program to us.
Well, I would have a program that would be just called Common Sense, or maybe The Gray Area, because when it comes to coverage of Iran, it's always extremes. And the media never covers anything in the middle. And I would focus on that middle ground. And, you know, one story I have to tell you, you mentioned the story with the hostage. Some of you may remember there were 52 Americans held hostage for 444 days, and there were two women in that group. And both Christmases, they actually showed the women on television. And one of them, one Christmas, one of them said, "Mom, if you're watching this, my weight loss is intentional." And I remember thinking, what a practical person, you know? I mean, she's a hostage. She's thinking, might as well lose weight. And it was, and she said it in such a witty way, and she left such an impression on me. And that was the former hostage that I ended up meeting. And I told her that I always remember her all these years for her practicality and wit. And we actually went on a car trip together through Iowa and Wisconsin, and I contacted all the media outlets, and I said, hey, I'm Iranian, I'm going on a car trip with a former hostage, and nobody was interested, no media outlet was interested. And I thought, God, the hostage and the humorist. I mean, I can see the headlines, but I just saw them in my head. And then I was telling this to my father, and he said, well, if you'd taken her hostage, you would have been on the news. So it's sad but true.
So while we are on
this... I think I need to take somebody hostage. I think that's like my next move.
Yeah. Yeah, that could be a nice movie, actually.
I think.
Better than a book. While we are on the subject of TV, obviously ABC has optioned Funny and Farsi.
They have.
Outside of your contract, can you tell us anything about that?
Yeah, they are actually currently working on a sitcom based on Funny and Farsi, and we'll see if it actually happens. So, it takes courage for a network to have a show with an Iranian character that's not a terrorist. And this would be a first. So I hope that ABC, if you're listening, goes ahead and does this. We'll see. I actually, they started having auditions, but actually they postponed it. But when they were having auditions, I kept getting emails on Facebook from actors, and they were saying, God, thank you. You know, for once I'm auditioning for something that's not poor Afghani villager or terrorist. But one thing that they did, though, for the pilot is they changed my husband from being French to being American, because they thought it's too much. You can't
too
have,
much.
Like, an too Iranian
much.
Woman and a French husband. You know, who's going to believe that?
They think the audience is too dumb to have three cultures at once.
I don't know. You said it, not me.
Amazing. Amazing that they would do that. But are you going to play in it? Do you have a cameo role?
Like Alfred Hitchcock? Do I get a cameo? I have no idea. We'll see.
So are they looking for Iranian actors?
Well, right now,
actors?
They're actually, it's being held up because they wanted a particular director. And so they're negotiating with this particular director. So everything's on hold until we see what happens.
Okay. Well, we have a lot more questions. You are listening, for our listeners, you are listening to Commonwealth Club radio program. We are talking to Firuzeh Dumal, Iranian-American author of Funny in Farsi and Laughing in Accent. Okay, back to questions. We have lots of questions. Now, somebody wants to know, since the publication of your first book, how has your life changed in terms of a woman who had a solitary, totally independent work and suddenly becoming a celebrity and children at home and all that other responsibilities that come to a woman?
Well, the biggest difference is, like, people now listen to what I have to say. And seriously, I mean, people are far kinder to me than they used to be. I mean, I would make a comment earlier and people would say whatever. But now that I'm a published author, when I say something, people go, God, that's so true. Oh, my, you know, and it's like, so there's a lot more, I think, profoundness to everything that I say and do.
Oh.
And the other difference is I travel. I travel a lot, like I mentioned earlier. I never, ever used to travel. So I've seen the United States, and it's been so interesting to me because I've gone to all these places that I would never go to normally, like rural Maine and all parts of the Midwest. And I've lived in California my whole life, and you know I thought, well, this is America. Well, it's really not. I mean, it's not until you go into these small towns in the Midwest and you really start to understand that America is a very diverse country, all types of people.
Yeah. So that's a lot of fun to actually...
Except I hate the traveling part,
yes.
You know, because I'm not one of those authors, you know, I'm not like going first class. I'm, you know, center seat Delta coach. So...
Delta, are you listening?
Yeah. So the traveling, I think there's a song that says the traveling was hell. Yeah, that would be my theme song. But I love going and meeting people and there are good people all over this country.
Yeah. Who is your idol?
My idol?
Yeah. Do you have any?
You know, I really like Eleanor Roosevelt.
Uh-huh. Hillary Clinton.
Is that yours?
No. No, I mean, her idol was Eleanor
Oh, really?
Roosevelt.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, she used to channel her when she was first lady.
Oh, I haven't channeled Eleanor yet, but maybe I will.
Eleanor Roosevelt. Obviously, she was an extremely intelligent, strong woman. What is specifically about Eleanor? Was there anything Iranian about Eleanor?
No. Eleanor did what she thought was right. And I really admire people who do that.
The courage.
And I have a lot of...
The courage of conviction.
Exactly. Yeah. Regardless of people around you are saying.
Yeah. There are an enormous amount of pressure on American kids, peer pressure, and all kinds of pressure. You know, parents wanting him to do 3 musical instruments. They want them to have 3 sports, whatever.
And then house.
The pop culture pressure, peer pressure, all of that. And you have 3 kids. 2 of them are in the age where they're difficult to manage. Right? I don't have kids, I understand at this age they're difficult to manage.
They're supposed to be, but I have 2 teenagers and a 3-year-old.
Yeah.
In fact, I have a kid at home right now writing college essays and another being potty trained. So we have the gamut of spectrum of life at our house right now. Mom, my teenagers are actually quite easy. I mean, I have to say, they're very nice kids. I haven't had any of the typical teenage experiences.
How are the teenagers? The little one is still too early to say what he or she is going to be. But the 2 teenagers, are they American? Are they Iranian? Are they French? More?
You know, they're really global citizens. I mean, they're a little bit of everything.
So how do you make them aware of their Iranianness or their Frenchness? Or they know they're American.
Right? Well, first of all, I have a world map in my kitchen.
Yeah.
And
like your mom, you can identify Iran on it.
Yeah, but my mom, I hope you're not listening. Okay, but geography is really important to me. I have this world map in my kitchen, and I always use any excuse to have my kids look up new countries or states. And you know, if something's in the news, like a couple weeks ago, like we looked up South Carolina, Appalachian Trail, and Argentina, same week. So any excuse to learn about the world. And so I think they know that it's important. You know, every country counts.
Yeah.
And there are countries that are richer than others, but they have other things to offer. And, you know, I think, if anything, my kids, they're just kind. They're very kind. I think that's probably that global part of me that feels like we all... Our lives all have the same value. Some of us own more things.
Yeah. So, of course, they've been all, you know, they've been to many countries except Iran. So.
Actually, they haven't traveled all that much. They've been to France, obviously. They haven't traveled all that much. We own a house, and that mortgage kind of kills us. So we don't travel as much.
Do they take Farsi lessons?
No. Because I asked them, do you want to? They said no. I said, fine.
Do they speak Farsi?
They understand it. But they don't speak it back to me.
Do you think somehow they may be embarrassed
No.
at times for being Iranian?
No, not at all.
Because the image of Iran is not that great?
No, not at all. Because the part of Iran that they know is my extended family. And anybody who has that family is pretty proud of being Iranian. In fact, I have 2 of my cousins here today. Hi, Nina. Hi, Sarah.
Okay. Obviously, you go to a lot of different places. You have different audiences. You go to universities. You go to schools. You go to church and synagogue. Who is your favorite audience? What kind of groupings do you think you interact best with?
You know, my favorite groups are the ones that are intelligent, because then they understand the nuances of everything that I say. And I don't have that awkward situation where I say something that is funny and people look at me like, what does she mean by that? But, you know, I have to say, I have not had, you know, knock on wood, everybody, I have not had a single bad speaking experience. I mean, every audience I've ever spoken to has gotten the gist of what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
And sometimes I do conferences and I'm the morning keynote, and every time they say, we put you in the morning so you'd wake people up. So that's always, sometimes the time I speak is as important as the audience.
Since June, obviously, for a while at least, Iran was on the news quite a bit, and there are continued to be pressures and tensions, political and otherwise. How do you feel about talk of U.S. doing something in Iran to impact this political process? Some would argue that we should help people there's an uprising going on, so we should help the people. Some would argue, no, stay out of it, we better do nothing. I have a sense that you don't want America to do anything. Could you elaborate a little bit so our American friends would understand where an Iranian like you comes from?
Well, I think, first of all, you asked me earlier who my heroes are. I'm going to have to add to that all the Iranians who have put their lives and actually lost their lives in protesting these elections. So, I mean, it's amazing to think that, you know, people would die because they were in the street just exercising a right that people have here, you know, freedom of speech. So I think the U.S. should get involved? No, because I think that I hope that Iran has a government someday soon that allows freedom of speech, that respects human rights. I want Evin prison torn down and a garden built instead. But do I think a U.S. invasion is going to get there? No. I don't
Not
think
necessarily
that
invasion, but some sort of proactive activity.
Proactive activity?
That's not a very good grammar. My poor English, yeah. But, I mean, do something to nudge the process in the direction of the will of the people.
Well, you know, I just don't know what that would be. I mean, if such a thing were possible, yes, I would say do that. But I have no idea what could be done. I mean, you know, in a situation like this, like what's going on in Iran right now, nobody knows. I mean, this is the truth. And people will come and say, well, this is what needs to be done. This is what needs to be done. Nobody knows. And all I can say is I want the long-term goal to be a country that respects human rights. Because if we have that, and even if it's within an Islamic government, I'm fine with that. But this is really a non-negotiating point. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how we can go from where we are now to having that type of government. That's what I'm hoping for. Mm. But I certainly don't think a military invasion of any kind is going to get it there. In fact, I think a military invasion would only strengthen the extremists. Mm-hmm. So maybe we could send Joe Wilson there, though. He could be a special envoy. Those South Carolina politicians, I'm telling you. Maybe we could send them all there. Not all, but just two of them.
So earlier you talked about the fact that you were the quiet kid and who stayed and looked at things and absorbed the details. And if I remember correctly, in one of the books you do talk about the fact from early on you liked to write. You enjoyed writing stories. And was there any aha moment or one of those turning point, something turns something on in your head when you say, yes, I'm going to write a book. I'm going to be a writer. Was there something
was
like that?
Actually, I joined a writer's group when my then youngest child started kindergarten. This was back in 2000, the year 2000. I had been a stay-at-home mom for 8 years. And, you know, I mean, I would die for my kids, but I was going bonkers as a stay-at-home mom. I mean, it was just, you know, if you've ever had a kid Velcro to your hip for 8 years, I mean, you know what it's like. I mean, you just want to go to the bathroom by yourself. And so I joined this writer's group. My aha moment happened the first time I read a story out loud to this group, because it was a bunch of strangers. And I read the story, and they started laughing. And then they said, can I have copies of it? And I thought, really? So that was my aha moment. That's why I'm all for working with strangers when it comes to writing. Because, you know, if you write a story and your mom says, oh, honey, this is just wonderful, you know, you're not going to believe that. Although that's not something my mom would say. But
what would your mom say?
My mom would say, don't you have laundry to do or something instead? My mom's a very practical woman.
Something more useful.
Right, exactly. Like, what's writing these stories going to get you? She was like, "Fuse a bikari, you know, yeah. Like, don't you have anything better to do?"
Okay. There are some Iranian things that are so peculiar to Iranians.
Oh, yeah.
That Americans have no notion of what it is. And one of those things...
Let's keep those secret.
I like Americans to get some sense of some of our weirdness. Taaruf is one of those weird things that Iranians do, and it's very hard for Americans to understand. Please describe taaruf.
Okay, so taaruf. So Iranians, you know, we're really into hospitality. We really are, genuinely. But we always have to invite you in for tea or dinner or lunch or please come and stay. And sometimes we don't mean it, but we have to say it. See, this is taaruf. So let's say you're an innocent victim and you happen to go to an Iranian's house and they say, please stay for dinner. And then you say, no, I can't. Because of taaruf, they have to say, no, I insist. Even though they're thinking, God, I hope he says no because I don't have enough food. So then you say no, you know, and then you're thinking, but maybe I'm going to hurt this person's feeling, so maybe I should say yes for the sake of world peace or something. So then you say, okay, yes, I'll say, and then they say, oh, my God, I'm so happy, khodar shok, and then they go in the kitchen, and they go, oh, my God, I have no food, what are we going to do? So that's the ugly side of taaruf. But the beautiful side of it is that we really do love to feed people.
Yeah.
So chances are 9 times out of 10, if somebody invites you to stay, they really do mean it.
So would you describe it as insincere flattering or insincere modesty? How would you put a word on it?
You know, there's not even like 3 words in English to describe it, because it's just something that doesn't exist. I mean, there's a lot of concepts that don't exist in English. Like,
right.
In French, there's a term, fringale, that means a little hungry. So you're not really hungry for a meal, but you're just hungry for a snack.
Yeah.
Whereas in America, you just say hungry. Like, yeah. Supersize it. But in France, fringale, I think that's a really lovely word. It's a lovely term to just have a little snack. So taaruf, and you know what? And let me tell you, for foreigners, it will take you a lifetime to figure it out. Because we fake it really well.
Yeah.
We're like, oh, please stay. Oh, I'm going to be so upset if you can't. Oh, please, please. And I don't mean it. So it's...
Yeah. Yeah, so that's one of the weirdest things about Iranian culture.
Well, you know what? I remember when I was a kid, and we lived in we moved to California. My father would always invite his coworkers to our house, always.
Yeah, well, yeah,
because you had to. Because
yeah,
you know, we just don't know how to have a relationship and not have you over for a meal.
Yeah.
And then my mother would say, "Well, I don't have no food. Why did you do that?" Because he'd come home from work and he'd say, "Oh, in an hour, like 4 people are coming," and she'd say, "Why did you do this?" And my dad would say, "Well, I had to ask." I mean, that's taaruf.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
you have to invite.
Right.
And they said yes, so now we have to feed them.
So do you do taaruf with Iranians?
You know what? I can't, because I have 3 kids, and I don't. I have too much responsibility. Taaruf takes too much time.
Yeah.
So if I invite you, I really mean it.
That's my problem, too. I have lost the sense of doing taaruf.
Yeah.
I haven't been in Iran long enough, so...
Well, you have to have
and
that...
Sometimes I feel awkward with Iranians, because I don't know how to do taaruf.
Well, don't feel awkward with me.
Okay.
I will.
All right.
Plus, you already invited me. Was that taaruf?
Yes.
Because I'm coming.
No. Right.
Now I'm feeling a little uncomfortable.
On the record, you are invited without taaruf.
You heard it, and it's on the radio and the internet.
It's on the radio.
Yeah.
Folks, you can hold me responsible to that. Okay, so talking about food, it is the love of my life. I love cooking. I love to eat. And I love to hear about what other Iranian women like you, who love to feed other people, do for if you have a dinner party. What do you cook? What do you serve? Iranian, French, American? What do you do?
Well, I'm a big fan of the local farmers market. I really believe in eating locally. And that doesn't sound like a stereotypical Northern California person, but I'm really not. But I love supporting the local farmers. So I go once a week to the farmers market, and if I'm having a dinner or a luncheon, I don't know what I'm going to make ahead of time. I go to the farmers market and I buy whatever is there. So it's always something in season, and you never know until you come to my house to know what it is. But I have a story to tell you, though, about food.
Tell this story.
Okay, so my husband, who's French, loves food. He loves food more than he loves me. Okay, I'm just saying this for the record, but that's okay. But so this summer he decided that he wanted to have a tapas night, and that the center of the tapas was going to be fresh grilled sardines. I don't know where he gets this from, but, you know, there are worse things that a middle-aged man could be doing.
That's good.
So he decided that he was going to find fresh sardines. Now, it's not easy to find fresh sardines in California.
Whole Foods has it.
Well, okay, you just ruined the story, but it's true. So we... So my husband, who, you know, should have called you, he goes on the internet and he finds there's all these Asian markets in San Jose, and he thinks they might have fresh sardines. So he spends a day with our three-year-old driving around all these Asian markets, and he does not find any fresh sardines. But he did mention that our three-year-old got a lot of free candy from all the employees in the Asian stores were very friendly to her. So not a good thing for the kid. But anyways, so he comes home without the sardines. So the next week he goes to our local fisherman, Pietro, at our market, and he says, Pietro, I'm looking for fresh sardines. And Pietro says, you got to go to Half Moon Bay, hang out at the docks early in the morning. And when the fishermen come, you have to ask them, do you have fresh sardines? So he tells me this, and I said, you know, that's fine, but don't take any of the kids with you, you know? So this is going on, and every day he's on the internet, he's like looking at all these fresh sardine sites. I mean, it's getting weird. So then finally, one day, and this is over like a two-month period, it's the day before school starts for our kids, and we had been on a trip, so there was no food at home. So he goes to Whole Foods to get a sandwich for our son, and he calls me, and he's out of breath. He's so excited. Like, I thought, like, he'd seen Salma Hayek in the produce aisle or something. And he says to me, you're not going to believe this. Salma Hayek. You love her. Okay. So he says, you're not going to believe this. They have fresh sardines at Whole Foods. And I said, really? And he said, yeah. So anyways, he comes home with a sandwich for our son and fresh sardines for himself. So our son always packs his lunch the day before. So he packs his lunch, and the next morning he opens the refrigerator, and his sandwich is sitting there. And he said, did Dad buy two sandwiches? I said, no, just one. And he said, wait, what did I pack? So he had packed the fresh sardines in his lunch because the packages looked like they were the same. They were about the same size. So he goes in his backpack, which now stinks, okay, because it has had fresh sardines in it, which are now not so fresh. So we throw the sardines out. His whole backpack smells. I'm spraying lavender oil on it. He's like, oh, no, now it smells even worse. And so he got rid of the backpack, you know, all his, like, notebooks he had to get rid of. Okay, goes to school. And my husband, of course, now does not have fresh sardines. So he goes back to Whole Foods the following week, gets more fresh sardines, and he comes back, and he's, like, you know, deboning them with, like, love that I have never seen. I mean, he is just, because he's looked it up on the internet
he's
for days
flirting
and days.
With them.
I mean, he's just gently, like, caressing the sardines, and he's like, look, I can do this with just one cut, and he's just, anyways. So then he's, you know, he puts the spices on, and then he also bought fresh grape leaves. So he wrapped them in the grape leaves, and then he goes outside and he grills them. And I'm telling you, they stink like you've never smelled anything. It's like cat food is what they smell like. So he brings them in on this platter, and our 14-year-old daughter says, oh, my God, it just smells so bad. I can't be in the kitchen. And she never does that. I mean, my kids eat everything. So she goes outside the house. And so then my husband says to me, here, taste this. So I taste one, and it tastes like cat food. So I said, you know, I don't like this. And so then he gives a taste to our 17-year-old son, who says more graciously than I'm just not in the mood for this. And so then my husband tastes it, and he says, wow, this is really fishy. And so anyways, they were inedible. It was like 2 months of a fantasy that came to this. But then what happened is the next day we were going to our block party. You know, a block party where they you know, close the street and everybody comes and brings chairs and brings food to share. So we took the sardines. And let me tell you, people loved them. Some people loved them. Not everybody. Sardines. But those who loved them, loved them. And so it was kind of a happy ending nonetheless. But it was like a two-month adventure that...
I mean, he's a French guy. So he knows what he's doing with food.
Well, not always, yeah. Well, yeah.
I mean, come on.
No, it turns out that there's different varieties of sardines.
Yeah?
And the kind we got was very fishy.
Stinky.
Yeah, so you have to go to Europe to get Portugal.
All right.
Well, that was a tangent, wasn't it?
No.
Yeah.
That was a fun story, actually. I want to say on the subject of food.
No more sardines.
Because it's such a common, it's a probably the commonest denominator for humanity is food. So when I have my... I love cooking. I cook all kinds of things. But when I have my Iranian family relatives over, I always make sure there's plenty of Persian food, and then I make some other things. What do you do that? Do you also serve Iranian food to your family? And
no.
What is your favorite?
I don't serve Iranian food to my family because they're all better cooks than I am. And they're very blunt. I mean, they'd be like, this tahin is not good. So I don't want to... My ego cannot handle that. So I serve them things that they don't know how to make.
I see.
So, yeah.
So that would be French.
And they don't know what it's supposed to taste like. So that's always an advantage because they can't criticize it because they think this is the way it's supposed to taste.
Ah, like what?
Like what? Like I'll make salmon. I'll put all kinds of herbs and spices on it, and you know you can't go wrong with that.
And they think it's French, and that's the way it's.
Yeah, you just give it a French name. People will believe anything. Right. One time we made madeleine. You know these little French little tea cakes, and my husband whipped them up too much, and so they came out really flat. They actually inflated in the oven, and then they flattened, and we had a lot of them. And so my husband says, no problem. So he took two of them and put jam in the middle. And he said, let's call them platine. It was just a name he made up. And we were having a party, and people were like, what are these? And we're like, platine. And people loved them. It was a complete lie.
So it sounds like he sort of fits you pretty well.
He lies like me.
You selected a good mate, it sounds like. I look forward to meeting him. So let's switch to something, another interesting thing, which is kids again. Obviously, you go to colleges, schools, and I assume you go to the little ones, school, you know, kids that are young or not?
No, I do junior high, high school, college.
Junior high. Okay, let's stay with junior high, the youngest. What is the most interesting question they ask you? Or what is the most common question they ask you?
Well, I'll tell you. First of all, I cannot tell you how much I love junior high kids. It is the most wonderful age because they have what's called a bullshit detector, and they know when you're telling the truth. And I really appreciate that about that age group. And you know, and they know that I'm telling them the truth. And also, apparently, my humor is right there with 13-year-olds too. So it works. But I love that age, and they ask great questions. One of my favorite questions I remember a kid once asked me. He said, when you're really mad, what language do you speak in? I know. And I said, I swear in all three languages. So that was. But, you know, they're very sincere. You know, yeah. If they like you, it's completely honest. You know, there's no tarof.
Yeah, there's no tarof.
No. And if they think you're a bore, they let you know that too. Although, thank God, I haven't had that yet, but.
Aren't they all on their BlackBerry or their iPhones all the time?
No, because usually when I go to school, it's like an assembly and it's like a big deal and they've been able to get out of some class they're trying to avoid anyways. So they're usually glad to be there. Plus, you know, you don't often in schools read a book that's funny. Most books, as my son once asked me, he said, do books have to be depressing to be on school reading lists? So usually when they read one of my books for their class, they're so surprised that they read a book that was funny, mm-hmm. that they're quite gracious with me.
Yeah. One of the audience is asking, how can the theme of food be used to enhance our shared commonalities and open up to each other and understand better?
Well, I think one of the wonderful things is just opportunities to actually bring food to, like if you work in an office, for instance, or, you know, for schools, if there's a holiday that highlights whatever culture you're from, bring food.
Bring food.
Yeah.
Another thing that I came across my mind is one of the most beautiful Iranian traditions and celebration is the celebration of the spring equinox. That's when the Persian New Year begins. Of course, it's Iranian New Year now, but originally it is started as the Persian New Year. It's the most beautiful celebration, beautiful food and all of this. Do you think that is a tool that we as Iranian Americans should use more frequently? And how should we do it to help our American friends have a deeper understanding of our culture?
Well, you know, I think the one thing that's missing in this world right now is people talking to other people. And it's ironic because we have all these ways to communicate. But really just sitting and talking to another person, I mean, it happens so rarely. And I think any opportunity to sit and talk about your culture and your background is one that should be seized upon. And whether it's because it's the Persian New Year or because you just want to invite your neighbors over for a Persian meal, I think it's all good.
Do you invite your American friends for your Nowruz celebration dinner?
Okay, so this is the thing. This is the guilt of being a working woman. My busiest months on the lecture circuit, one of them is March, and Persian New Year, I am never home. I'm always giving a lecture somewhere.
Oh.
So I actually...
Is that an excuse not to cook?
No. I'm not that desperate. But I, so my French husband does the half scene. And so,
I want to see a French half scene now.
And we tend to sort of leech off our Iranian friends. We tend to, my husband will take the kids to like other Iranians' houses so they get their share of Persian food while I'm off working and paying the mortgage.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we have a couple minutes left. Time, it's been wonderful. It went so fast. There is time for one more question. And the way I would like to do it is to ask you, is there a question that any of your interviewers have missed asking you? Is there a question that you would like to be asked and nobody asked you?
Well, I think one thing I'm really sensitive to right now is, again, the way the media covers anything that has to do with the Middle East. I feel like if it's freakish, it's going to be in the news. And if it's anything normal or not frightening, there's no way that it will ever make the news. And I just wish that more Americans would realize that it's sort of like, coming to America and not knowing at all what Americans are like and only, you know, reading the police blotter in your local paper and thinking, well, this is my community. So I wish there were a channel, which I would like to be the president of, and then we can have programming. Like, it would be like the Not Scary channel, and it would cover all cultures, not just Iran. Yeah. But I feel like when it comes to the Middle East, you know, we're so woefully misrepresented. So I think any opportunity that Middle Easterners have here to make bridges, whether it's through food or music or whatever, I think we should do it.
Well, I think we are coming close to the end of our program, Firuzeh. It's been a pleasure and honor to speak with you, and I promise you I'll cook you a very nice Persian dinner.
You all heard it.
Again, our thanks to Firuzeh Dumas, author of the books Funny in Farsi and Laughing Without an Accent. We also want to thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. Tonight's program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I'm Jaleh Dai, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more of the more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Good night.
Thank you.